You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Hello, friends. I'm so glad you could join me today, you beautiful people. If nobody's told you you're beautiful today, know that you are. Let's get to it. Everything I talk about today will be under the banner of human nature, and we'll see where this goes. It'll be lengthy, probably, but the article I wrote recently, Americans in the High Castle, I said in that piece that politics isn't my favorite topic to write about or even discuss, but it fits so well into a topic that I am passionate about, which is human nature. To me, it feels like right now we're living in a movie where we get to watch the show for free. I keep saying this timeline is wild, and there's a quote that I've always liked that says, "May you live in interesting times." I had always kind of thought that we were living in interesting times, what with the internet and all, being so connected by way of social media. And this could be due to my nature. I tend to be easily awed. Like, I'm the guy, I will stop in the middle of a hike and watch the working ants. You know, those little ants that can carry a piece of bark on their back? I'll watch them just to see what happens for 10 minutes. It fascinates me. I also like going to museums for the same reason. I'm awed by the intricacies of an impressionist painting, let's say, and getting that sense of awe. I love that feeling. Like, how did he do that? Which is why AI, I don't think, will ever have a chance of replacing creativity. Because if you were to stare at the Mona Lisa and know that it wasn't done by human hand, nobody would be impressed because you wouldn't get that sense of awe. It's been said that art is driven primarily by the mating instinct. So even if you don't realize it, when you put yourself out there, it serves our biological impulse to create or procreate, which we're trying to attract the attention for that reason, trying to attract attention of the opposite sex to perpetuate our genes. I can tell you that's not why I'm here, but you know, maybe subliminally or just unknowingly, that has something to do with it. I don't know. But yeah, you could say I'm easily awed and easily amused, which I think is a positive. Remember, I've said people who mock those who laugh at their own jokes, I always think it sucks for you that you don't, because laughing at your own jokes makes for a more joyful existence. Who wouldn't want to laugh more? That's something else that would get me laughed at, I guess, being easily amused, but I hope that I always am. You know, this could explain it. I'm pretty sensitive in a lot of ways, which if you met me, you wouldn't think so. But I'm not sensitive in the Gen Z sense, but I feel emotions pretty easily. And as I alluded to last episode, I'm pretty good at channeling those emotions toward productive ends or creating what I consider to be the most optimal outcome in more tense interactions or situations. I want to get a few political thoughts out of the way before we start. When people are trying to determine who was president the last 4 years, one person that I never hear identified or read it anywhere is Hunter Biden. But if my dad said that I was the smartest person he knew, and I knew that he was 80 years old and had met a lot of people, especially working in government for 50 years and trying to get elected, if my dad had dementia, you best believe I'd be visiting him often and probably making decisions on his behalf in tandem with his wife, my stepmom, of course, you know, the Dr. Jill of our family. But that's what a loving son would do, right? So I'm sure Obama had a hand in it, and Susan Rice and Jill Biden. But yeah, they were probably all involved. Anthony Blinken surely could have been the puppet master behind the scenes, but my money would be on the president's son because he and dear old dad had been partners in crime around the world for years, taking in millions of dollars for the family, which is why they were issued preemptive pardons, of course, something that's never been done before. So why would the corruption stop when the big guy became president? That wouldn't make sense. There is so much being disclosed right now about what's been going on at the highest levels of our government with USAID. I don't know if you've seen that. Over 1,000 NGOs are connected to USAID, which doesn't stand for aid at all. It's an international development sort of thing. The war in Ukraine, a lot of that is getting disclosed, where hundreds of thousands of people on each side of the conflict died, which President Trump said that he wanted the war to end because he didn't want people to keep dying, which is the right thing to say. I mean, how do we not get on the phone with Putin and try to resolve that conflict? Well, it's also been shown that we probably provoked Russia by crossing Putin's red line. Putin didn't want NATO to expand to his border to the southwest of him. For those of you who don't know NATO, NATO is the, it stands for North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It was formed after World War II and at the start of the Cold War to defend the West against Soviet aggression. There are 32 countries who are party to this treaty, which states that if you attack one, you attack them all, which is why when Trump came to office the first time, there was a stipulation in the treaty saying you had to contribute a certain percentage of your GDP to be part of NATO. And, you know, it was like dad coming home, which is what's happening right now. It's like dad has come home and he's going to maintain order or get the country back in order. So, yeah, all the member states would come to the defense of each other should they be attacked. And the headquarters is in Brussels, Belgium, which is a place I've been and that I didn't really like. The part of Belgium I did like was called Bruges. It is picturesque. It's spelled B-R-U-G-E-S. So yeah, Putin didn't want NATO to expand to include a country that was once part of the Russian Empire. A lot of Ukrainians speak Russian, and Russia now controls roughly 20% of Ukrainian territory. And of course, when Putin learned of the bioweapons program we were funding near the Russian border, he had enough and he attacked, as he said he would. Also, something else that was revealed recently was a 2014 Victoria Nuland phone call where it was leaked on Sunday from a conversation she had in 2014 where she was strategizing as to how they were going to overthrow the democratically elected president of Ukraine and who they plan to install in that person's place. And she implicated Joe Biden, saying that he was on board with what they were going to do. I guess she'd never seen a mob movie or been to the spy museum in D.C., which is worth a visit if you're there. But how could you be so clueless that you can't discuss these matters on the phone? You meet in person and pat them down the way Diddy did to Bieber to make sure they're not wearing a wire. A lot of people are playing CYA right now, too. So Zelensky came out on Sunday saying that the U.S. sent almost $200 billion to Ukraine, but he said he doesn't know what happened to $102 billion of it. So it looks like our government had a giant money laundering operation, which they would distribute probably half the money appropriated to themselves. If you ever wondered why D.C. has the wealthiest zip code in America, you're wondering no more. Another thing that's been revealed is that our intelligence agencies use abortion and identity and DEI and manipulating elections to, well, the abortion identity stuff, they use that to divide the country that they want to take control of. You keep the populace at each other's throats, and so they're good and distracted while they overthrow the democratically elected president and proceed to wash money through there, either by bringing in BlackRock to rebuild or whatever. It's possible those in our government don't view America as their country, is my opinion, which is why you never see American flags at a Democrat protest, for example. But rather, they're protecting their own interests, taking care of their own family and their friends, and enriching themselves, which is kind of like a conspiracy theory you always hear growing up. Like you have that crazy uncle who's talking like Alex Jones and telling you about the CIA is involved in Hollywood or whatever, but yeah, count me as one of those people now, I guess, which we all should probably be now if you are paying attention. It would explain globalism, or why we call them globalists, because the de facto head of all this globalism is the most powerful man in the world. It was Biden, right? He was the president of America, the most powerful country in the world, who he was working with Ukraine. And the prince, by Hunter, was on the board of Burisma, which was a Ukrainian energy company. And, of course, they took millions of dollars from the Chinese. And this gets back to the bioweapons. So if COVID was a bioweapon, it may not have been – they probably didn't plan to use it against other countries necessarily, but you use it when you need it. And if you don't consider Americans to be your fellow countrymen, you'd have no problem unleashing it on the population where you live. And COVID would be the perfect weapon, if in fact it's a bioweapon. I'm purely speculating here, but because think about it. Those that died had an average of 3.8 comorbidities. Average. That means those who had two, others had six. And you'll hear your everyday American say, well, that can't be true. You know, there's no way it was deliberate because China wouldn't unleash a virus on its own population. Well, one thing they did do was shut down travel within China and allow it internationally so the virus could spread worldwide. And yeah, communists have never unalived their undesirables. That's never happened. Of course not. They'd never kill 40 million of their own people. That's why you study history, so that you understand better. Because in Maoist China, they did in fact starve their own people and kill an estimated 40 million people, which that wasn't that long ago. With the whole human nature thing, something I've benefited from in my life is conversation slowing down, which I've never talked about before. You remember Michael Jordan after that game one in the finals against Portland, the Portland Trail Blazers? It was 1992. When he hit the 6 three-pointers in the first half. I watched that game in Grand Isle, Louisiana with my buddy Bretto. Where you at, Brett? But I remember the GOAT, Jordan, saying after that game, I think it was a commercial, and he said the basketball hoop looked like a big old huge bucket. What he's talking about is flow state, when you're in the zone, quote-unquote. By the way, there's a book called Flow by a Polish author whose name I can't pronounce. One of my favorite books. If you're looking for a page-turner. A lot of times when I get in the zone, it's in conversation. And what happens is the conversation slows down for me the same way a basketball game would. This is funny. About 3 years ago, I took the fam to a baseball game between Nicholls State and Valdosta State. Nicholls State is, of course, my alma mater. So we went to a baseball game, and I'm posted up right behind the plate. And it's a winter game between two small schools, so you can pretty much sit where you want, right? Valdosta State is where Bryce Drew went. You remember Bryce Drew hit that three-pointer? His dad was the coach. He hit that three-pointer to win a game in March Madness, and it was just awesome, very memorable. He actually played here in Houston for the Rockets, little white guy, pretty good. So I'm watching these at-bats behind the plate, and I couldn't believe how fast the ball was coming from the pitcher's hand. And I was thinking, how did I used to hit that? It was probably in the upper 80s, if I had to guess, and I couldn't believe it. Everything was moving so fast. Which happened to me, too, when I would travel internationally for a while and then come back to the States and drive. I felt like the cars were driving so fast, which, you know, I felt the same way, too, when I had my brain taken away this time last year. I went on manoverseas.com and I read some of the stuff that I used to write, like especially the top 40 list that I wrote on my 40th birthday. I couldn't believe that was me. I mean, I was like, how did I know this stuff? It was crazy. And speaking of being easily amused, I guess I amused myself, right? But I was in such bad shape. And I will share that story soon. If you already know what I went through, that means I love you. And because, I haven't shared that story wildly, but I will. There are a lot of benefits to experiencing conversations in slow-mo, so to speak. Because what it enables you to do is to think faster so that you have options to choose from in what you want to respond when it's your turn to talk. The other thing I experience is people's facial movements in slow-mo, which helps a lot when you're trying to read people. I think it's why I'm pretty good with lie detection. And as I've said, this is something you can work on by carefully studying human nature. I'm not going to make this episode about lie detection, but I'll give you a quick tip if you want to get better at reading people and better at discerning BS, which is a skill set. But what you first need to do is get a baseline of what they're doing when they're telling the truth. So, for example, some people, when they're trying to recall something that actually happened, they'll look down and to the left, for example. Then when they're trying to make something up as to what happened, they'll look you directly in the eyes, maybe without blinking. And what they might be doing is trying to read your face to see if you're buying their bullshit. And if you signal to them by your facial movements that you believe them, then their face will often betray their satisfaction that you're buying their BS. It's usually very slight, but if you look carefully enough, you'll see that they're pleased that you're buying it. And then you can adjust accordingly. knowing you're dealing with someone who's full of it. Now, everybody's going to be different. So don't think, oh, he's looking down and to the left, he's lying. That's not going to work. Everybody is different. And you can never be 100% with lie detection. So it's important that you establish a baseline for what they do when they're telling the truth. So ask them a basic question that you know to be true. You know, when were you born or where were you born or whatever. I've seen where some prominent pundits have said that the best way to respond to a stupid question, whether it's in these Senate hearings or a reporter asking a boneheaded question, which we've seen a lot of lately. I don't know if you saw the woman who, after that terrible aviation accident in D.C., she asked Trump, she said, do you think your common sense and observations will interfere with the investigation? What? In that case, he didn't say clown question, bro, but you know, I'm sure he was thinking it. But the advice that I've heard is to say something like, you need to ask a better question, which is what Trump told Caitlin Collins when she asked a clown question. Her question was something like, do you think your comments about DEI are giving comfort to the families impacted by the crash? And he told her that's not a very smart question and that he expects better from her. Again, that's a good response, but the reason I don't like it is because there's a strong rebuttal to it. Something I would think would be optimal, and that's what you're trying to achieve, right? A sort of kill shot where they're left with nothing. And if somebody told me to ask a better question, I'd say, okay, I will, but answer this one first. No different than if somebody tells you to go F yourself. And that's not a kill shot because the rebuttal there is, okay, I will, but after I finish and it's a sweet, sweet release, I'll come back and, you know, you get the idea. And one of those things that's interesting about having lived before the internet is we remember a time when you had to think on your feet. I don't know if you've heard, but a lot of young people nowadays don't like talking on the phone. And one of the main reasons is, according to them, is that they feel put on the spot. They're not given time to think about what they want to say because they're used to electronic communication where they can take as much time as they need to respond to whether it's somebody talking shit on X or replying to a text or whatever. I remember when texting became a thing, me and my buddy Chase talked about how incredible it was that we were given all this time to think of a response. It truly felt like cheating. I'll give you a few examples from last week on X, a few Twitter beefs I got into. I know a lot of you aren't on there, so I'll share the interaction. If you want to follow me, I'm @man_overseas. I think my name is CoachManOverseas on there. And these are examples of kill shots where the Trump card was played, not the President Trump, but the Trump card where they're left with nothing. So maybe you can use some of them in your beefs. So the first one is some professor posted the bio of a woman who had died in the DC plane crash, and some a-hole replied and said that karma was a bitch because this woman who died was a Marxist. She was about to start working at Harvard. And as someone familiar with Marxist theory, he knows Marxism leads to a lot of death and destruction, and therefore his perspective was that her death was merely accelerated by a few years. It was a very a-hole thing to say, but this professor, who was also likely a Marxist, albeit probably unknowingly, she replied to him calling him a coward and then tried to diminish his opinion by saying how many followers he had. In other words, she stooped to his level, to which he says, I'm just saying Marxism is a hard life and doesn't end well. And the professor says, your follower count sounds like karma. And she makes a laughing emoji. And then somebody else comments and addresses her as Dr. whatever and says, please don't engage him. And the doctor, the professor, says that she reported him. Pretty Marxist, right? She's going to do the infantile tattletale thing. I guess she's still thinking we're living in 2021 and maybe he'd be canceled. But she says, I reported the slurs and got an answer from Trump Kingdom that it's fine. And that's when I decided to give my two cents. I said, we were all with you till that last comment. And then I said, be sure to count my followers before you reply, Doc. Sweet credentials. Because she has the doctor and the PhD after her name, which is so cringe to me. Like, just show us you're smart by your thoughts. Anyway, it reminds me of the dude who advertises that he's on the football team, like the university football team, and he's got the bumper stickers all over his car. And that guy never sees the field. It reminds me of a guy, I met this guy one time at an LSU tailgate, and when I was introduced to him, I was told that he had pitched at LSU. Well, he was on the roster. I looked him up, and I believe what I saw was he had two relief appearances when they were winning like 17-2. And then I saw him on social media, and his profile pic is of him in an LSU uniform, and his description of himself was like number 46, former pitcher, LSU Tigers. And he's in, you know, he's my age. What are you doing? Another one would be the account Unusual Whales, W-H-A-L-E-S, Unusual Whales, also a good follow on X. He posted saying Costco is raising their pay for its hourly workers to more than $30 an hour per Bloomberg. And somebody says, you can't if you're white due to their DEI policy. And some dude replies and says, I know multiple people who have worked at Costco, dumbass, multiple white people. And he tells him that you got passed up for the job because you suck. And then I said, I've never seen a white person working at my Costco in Houston, and I go once a month. To which he says, must be a bunch of lazy whites out there. And I said, there aren't a bunch of whites, lazy or otherwise. In fact, there are more Hispanics than whites in Houston. So he says in quotes, so he's trying to quote me, he says, my Costco doesn't employ white people. No white people live near my Costco. Do you know how dumb you sound? And I said, I'm probably not as smart as you, but I do know how you big brains work, which is when they say, so what you're saying is, remember Kathy Newman with Jordan Peterson? I don't know if she advertises her credentials, but certainly thinks she's a big brain, being Oxford educated and all. So my reply to this guy was, I'm probably not as smart as you, but I do know how you big brains work. And then I used the quote, so what you're saying is, ... because obviously that's not what I said. And I said, fortunately, I'm smart enough not to expect stupid people to know they're stupid. And he's done. This is another one. Some lefty said that Catholic tradition, in quotes, is self-serving. And somebody, presumably a Catholic, says to him, are you insane? The church existed underground for hundreds of years because it was heavily persecuted by the Roman Empire. It's difficult to imagine being this ignorant and spouting off anyway. Of course, this is something I've talked about quite a bit, which is that those who feel the strongest generally know the least. So I said with a laugh, have you never met a leftist? If they had to understand both or all sides of an issue before opining, they'd never speak and wouldn't be leftists. Similar to if socialists understood economics, they wouldn't be socialists. By the way, one of the best comebacks I've ever seen is when that fruitcake David Hogg, who was arguing with a Christian against the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, and he said he thought he had a kill shot. He said, how many guns did Jesus have? But the Christian replied and said, not enough to avoid being killed by his own government. That's a kill shot. I could watch dummies who don't know they're dumb. I could watch that stuff all day. It's like people don't realize that there's 20% of the population who are indeed the bottom quartile of people in our population. They're, you know, and like when you encounter them, it's like it doesn't occur to them that these people are in the bottom quartile of the population in terms of brain power. You know, we weren't all born equal, unfortunately, but well, maybe, I don't know if it's unfortunately, but you get where I'm going. And so I guess it surprises them. And of course, the people in the 25% would never know it, because if they were able to make accurate assessments of their own intelligence, they probably wouldn't be in the bottom quartile. But Thomas Massie had a great example of this last week. So Thomas Massie is a Republican congressman who's got a master's degree in engineering from MIT, but is somehow not autistic. And he doesn't have a bunch of letters after his name trying to convince us he's smart. He's actually very smart. And he was being questioned by Jamie Raskin. Jamie Raskin, if you don't know, is the designated Democrat that they trot out when they need somebody to sell a hoax to the useful idiots. Well, he and Adam Schiff are the most prominent Dems who don't have any shame in their game. They're team players. And if politics were a fraternity, they'd be the guys with the frat daddy t-shirt, front tucked with a matching hat, bumper stickers on the car. But Massie is demonstrating to Congress how inflation works. And he used a glass of tea to demonstrate. And he pours water in it, which of course dilutes the tea. And he's saying that the water is like a money printer. When the government prints trillions of dollars, as they did under the Biden administration, it diluted the money that we hold, making it not completely worthless, but certainly worth less. And Raskin, in all his intellectual heft, thinks that he's got him. He says to Massie, Sir, inflation occurred not just in the U.S., but around the world. And Massey looks at him and he says, yeah, all the other countries printed a ton of money too, at the same time. That's a kill shot. Let me see if I have another one. Do you know who Shane Parrish is, the Farnham Street founder? He said that no other platform has done more to give power back to the people than X. And somebody named Nino replies and says, surprising and disappointing. If all the synthesis of the world's greatest thinkers you do got you here, that's a negative return on investment. So I said, LOL, enjoy the four-year hoax fest. The four-year hoax fest. Have you shared the Elon Nazi hoax yet? Which she had. I had looked at her profile. And she says, hoax. He did a Nazi salute twice. And I laughed and said, you don't really believe that. I said, did you get got by the fine people hoax, or were you smart enough to see through it? To which she replies, if you're too brainwashed to see it for what it is, I can't help you. Enjoy the dark side. And I said, I'll take that as a yes. And I added that you're not a little girl anymore, presumably. Wise up. And she said, I should wise up. Serious journalists all over the world are calling it what it is, a Nazi salute. You're in some dumbed-down American news right-wing echo chamber. No humility for how basic and played your thinking is. Which I thought that was pretty good. So I retweeted it just to demonstrate how these people think. Like, how do these women operate a car or get hired to do a job? You know, a job that's not packing bottles or counting out how many Tic Tacs go in a bottle. I'll never understand it. So when she saw the laughing emoji, she says, yes, an emoji just about sums up the shallowness of your argument. And I said, it's hard to believe you're a real person. And said, I wouldn't show my face either if this were my real opinion, because her profile pic was set to she had a sunset as her profile pic or something. Which I'm violating my rule of not replying to the faceless, but I'm one of those weirdos that engages sometimes. I guess it provides a little rush, but I kind of see it as an opportunity to sharpen your intellect. Like, people don't often debate. A lot of people don't want to. Like, I'll debate my stepdad on politics or whatever, and my mom tries to intervene and say, y'all need to stop, as if we're arguing and about to fight. But men don't work that way. We like it. It sharpens our intellect. So I go on to say, you're on a team and therefore lack objectivity. You're the ultimate example of a salute truther. It's either laugh or study people like you, and I prefer to laugh. And she says, you really can't string a coherent argument, can you? String together a coherent argument. God help the people you coach. And I said, I pray for them daily. Thank you, Nino. And I gave her the prayer thank you emoji, and she went away. So anyway, yeah, it feels like cheating sometimes when you have time to think about how you want to respond, whether it's 5 minutes or 15 minutes or 5 seconds. It doesn't matter to people. It's not like they think, oh, well, you had so much time to think about it. It's not real life anymore. It's all electronic communication. You don't have to think on your feet. Let's do one more. I'll share a beef that I had on X. Another one. Somebody said, is Donald Trump the coolest president we've ever had? I think so. And a few things I've said about Trump is that, if nothing else, a 78-year-old man with his work ethic should be an inspiration to every American. Is that something you've thought about? Like, I believe I'll remember how hard he's working or how sharp he is for the rest of my life. Like, when I'm in my 70s, I'll have no excuse for memory lapses or getting complacent or anything like that, because he's providing an example of what's possible at that age, like we've never seen before. It is so impressive. Well, in response to this gal who said that he was the coolest president we've had, I said our kids and grandkids someday will be riding on streets and bridges and working in buildings, attending schools, flying out of airports, all bearing his name. And some loser chimes in and says, well, let's hope we see a tombstone soon. And I'm not going to tell you what I said, because this is a family show, at least a family show in the sense that it's suitable for families, as long as those family members are of a certain age. I heard Rogan say one time that his daughter's friends would come over to his house and say, I love your podcast. And he was thinking, yeah, you're probably too young to be listening to the podcast. Well, you know what? Considering that, I'll go ahead and tell you. I'm usually not at a loss for words when an evil effing effer chimes in on X, but I think you got me, Gary. And this second effer wasn't the same word as the first effer. The second effer is a word that is suddenly allowable again, free speech and all. But of course, it's not something you would call someone who is attracted to the same sex, let's say. It's just like the R word. We'd all be wise to heed the words of Michael Scott, who said that you'd never call someone who is retarded retarded. No, that's what you call your friends who are acting retarded. quick story. So I was at a party. This isn't very long ago, maybe a couple months. And I used the R word. And there was a girl there that got pissed, like real pissed. But in her defense, she said that I kept using the word after she was offended, which probably isn't cool on my part. But somebody may have spiked my mouth with an edible because I don't remember. I don't recall continuing to use the word because that wouldn't be cool. But yeah, what are you going to do? Add her to the list of people who don't like me, I guess. I'd always been friendly with her before that night, but like we had had good conversation. I liked her husband. But evidently, she has someone in her family. I found this out afterward. She has somebody in her family who is autistic, which, you know, she doesn't know this, but my godchild is autistic. So story within a story. I once dated a girl who she would hear me say, "Are you retarded or something?" Because, well, she probably deserved it. I don't know. But one time we were hanging out and I said it again. And if you don't recognize it, that's from Good Will Hunting. "Are you retarded or something?" And she got real serious and said, "I don't think we should use that word anymore." And I laughed because I figured she just didn't want to be called out for being retarded. But she says, "We have a friend now who just had a baby with Down syndrome, so I don't think we should use that word," which is crazy to me because, like, it took you knowing somebody afflicted with a mental handicap, as if that's the first person you've known in your life. Like, have you never done anything charitable or, you know, with people who struggle that way? So my best man's brother, who I've known for 30 years, he has a condition that requires supervision the rest of his life. Like, he can't leave on his own. Like, he can't live on his own. And I told that story to him, and he said, "Well, can you ask her if I can still use the word?" Which was great. Now that I think about it, one of my best buddies has a special needs daughter. Are you telling me because I've used the R word that I'd be less likely to drop everything I'm doing to help my buddy's daughter if she needed it? No, of course not. Hell, I've written multiple checks to a school project that rescued handicapped kids in Indonesia. And I say rescued because they were in a terrible spot. So according to their Balinese Hindu religion, that they used to believe that if you were born in these kids' condition, that you'd been reincarnated that way, like born with this, because you were reincarnated due to something bad you did in a past life. So they used to hide them away from society and keep them in closets. How awful is that? Well, now that I think about it, my wife and I actually volunteer taught at the school, the school project, twice, actually. So anyway, to the overly sensitive types, I'm sure you're a better person than me, but you know, get over yourself. I was talking about this evil loser. So he wished death upon a president. His name was Gary. And I told him I'm not usually at a loss for words when evil people like him say things like that. But I said, "You got me." And he says, "You prefer headstone? Well, there you go." Remember, I've said one of the things Trump has contributed to society, in my opinion, is he's allowed those who are evil among us to come out of the shadows. And we're seeing it everywhere. People who wish their political opponent death, to be shot in the head on live TV. But I looked at this guy's profile, and dude's not even American. He was born he lives in Ontario. So I said, are you in Canada, eh? Didn't realize our president was such a real estate mogul that he owns a bunch of real estate in some lonely Canuck's head. Hilarious. And Gary's done. So I think I'm a lot like Trump in this regard, in that you better come strong if you're going to attack me, because I'm going to hit back, and you're probably not going to like it. I don't think I've ever seen Trump attack anybody who hadn't first attacked him. Maybe he has, and I'm just not aware. And when they do, they're usually overmatched. Whereas these batshit crazy women in the Senate, which I don't know if you've noticed, the ones who attacked Kennedy last week, the nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services, they were all the ones who received the most money from pharmaceutical companies. That's why they volunteered, I'm going to attack him. Do you think the average American realizes that? I'm not sure. I mean, our news isn't going to help us. The best was when Bernie Sanders did his performance, which was idiotic and laughable. Are you in favor of these onesies? This is what he said. He had a big poster illustrating onesies for everybody to see. Do you think he'd have made an ass of himself like that if all that money he gets from Big Pharma didn't compel him to act a donkey? Like, he was literally making an ass of himself for all the world to see. I don't think he would have done that if he weren't getting so much money from pharma companies. And then equally hilarious, Kennedy called him out. Bernie Sanders is the biggest proponent of universal health care in America. So he says to Bernie, in 2020, Bernie, you were the biggest recipient of money from Big Pharma. And did you see what Bernie did in that moment? I'm sure he's never been a bigger advocate for censorship in his life. He didn't want that kind of information to be known. So he puts his hand in the air as if he could somehow stop what was being said. And he goes, no, 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 no. He just kept saying no. But it was floating. You know, Kennedy said it. It escaped into the zeitgeist. And sorry, Bernie, you got to bask in the glows of the Bernie bros through your 70s and early 80s. Hell, even Joe Rogan was a Bernie supporter. One interesting note on that. You know, Kamala wouldn't do Rogan, which probably hurt her campaign. And I'm sure she didn't do it because you can't really keep up the facade for 3 hours. You're going to be exposed. Which, when I think back to when Bernie was on Rogan, you know, he only did an hour. Rogan's done over probably 2,300 episodes. You know how many of them have been only 1 hour? Just Bernie. It says something. So the truth of us, the truth that the rest of us have known for years is that Bernie's as corrupt as the rest of those espousing an American socialist utopia, which all the talk about equality, I mean, we've always known that under socialism, communism, these politicians try to create equality. And if you've read Orwell's Animal Farm, you know that all the animals on the farm are equal, except some are more equal than others. But they may have been espousing that, not like the DEI stuff. Like, that might have just been to get people at our throats while they rule over their own country, which is their family and their friends. So they don't care about us. They're not trying to equalize things. And, you know, redistribution of wealth is part of that. You get to be the arbiter of fairness. But anyway, I don't think it'll rear its ugly head until probably people my age die out, and then young people are, you know, not smart enough to know history, or, you know, as long as we don't teach history, then it'll come back. But yeah, Bernie, your fraud has been revealed. Sorry about that, bro. He went on to say, it was only $1.5 million. Good one, Bernie. You may need to get on X and practice your comebacks, because that is not helping you. And what, maybe 10% of the population saw through him before? Now it's maybe, what, a third, 25% of people know that he's a fraud? And I'm doing my part now to disseminate that he's a phony to all 53 of you listening. The dots have been laid out for people, so now all they need to do is connect them. If you need help, I can, like, think about this. Bernie Sanders, why would he get so much money from Big Pharma, be the number one recipient of Big Pharma money? Well, he's the face of universal health care. He's its biggest advocate. Who is enriched when everyone is forced into single payer? You connect the dots. Something else that's happening in this real-time movie we're living through is a lot of those who are on the take are being exposed, like the Bill Kristols of the world. He tweets all the time in a way that would make you say, Are you on the take? Like, are you a member of the intelligence community? So Bill Kristol, when I was a kid, hell, even in my early adulthood, he was a neoconservative type. Well, now we're starting to, it's being revealed that maybe there aren't neoconservatives. Like, maybe you're pro-war for a reason, because of the kickbacks, the money laundering. He became a never-Trumper. And then, of course, recently, Doge shut down USAID, and it was revealed that he was taking money from some, I want to say it was like a defending philanthropy or democracy, which of course means bureaucracy, something like that. And it was all funded by USAID. It's funny, on Sunday night, he posted on X something like, or I know what he said. He said, "I'd rather the deep state than the Trump state." Well, of course you would, bro. And a Doge investigator had just discovered where his money was coming from, and then they reposted it and said, "You are exposed." And then even Elon Musk retweeted it, which of course he has over 100 million followers or whatever. So all this time, when you're reading all this stuff that these deep state connected pundits say, and you're thinking, this cannot be your real opinion. Who is paying you? That's all coming out now. So it's not just evil people who are revealing themselves. It's all of these connected types that are on the take. It's like, I have a friend who worked at Macy's, and she told me that whenever somebody would try to pay with a check, she'd say, "Oh, okay, well, just let me run a credit check. And before I take this check," and they would be up in arms and get all huffing and puffing. And she said that was always the ones whose checks didn't, you couldn't cash. So, you know, if you had no problem with it, you just kind of chill and wait for the result. But anyway, human nature. History will show, I think, that, well, history has shown that in communist revolutions, which is, we're discovering now, like, you're either on the take or you're a useful idiot, is kind of how I see it. Did you happen to see the Selena Gomez video where she cried for the rapists and murderers being sent back to their home castles? Homegirl set up a camera and got the lighting right. And if she did one take, it'd be the first time a girl has ever done a selfie of any sort and just posted the first one, right? But imagine crying hysterically, yet still having the presence of mind to grab your phone and set it up to show the world how heartbroken you are. In the article I wrote comparing countries to castles, she was the main culprit I had in mind of the histrionics I alluded to. Celebrities who get to live in the swankiest part of the castle, well, she lives in a mansion in Hollywood, and she got rich playing pretend. She's an actress, so she was crying over the deportation of criminal gangbangers. And, of course, didn't cry when the 12-year-old girl who was raped and murdered where I live, she didn't cry for her. She didn't cry when previous presidents deported millions of illegals. No, she cried because Trump gave the order. But what else would you expect a phony to do? One of the things that gets left unsaid in our political discourse is how many of these women have mental illness. Remember Michael Savage? He wrote a book called Liberalism is a Mental Disorder. How prescient was that? The book was written maybe 15, 20 years ago. Now that we know more than the majority of liberal women have been shown to have some sort of mental illness that they're taking prescription medicine for. And maybe our new president should call for an investigation into what's causing all the mental illness in our country. I don't know if Big Pharma's behind the cover-up of this prevalence of mental illness, but if they are, it makes sense that our elected representatives are part of the cover-up too. Not looking out for Americans, they're looking out for themselves. That's what most of the performances at the hearing last week, that's what they were about. The same way, remember Adam Schiff tried to probe our new Attorney General, Pam Bondi, to find out if he'd be investigated? And Democrat senators did the same with RFK Jr. Pocahontas basically asked Kennedy if he was going to sue pharmaceutical companies because she's scared, she's worried. She's taken a lot of money from drug companies. Not as much as Bernie. He takes the cake there. He is married to Big Pharma. They take the cake and paint each other's faces with it at the reception, as is tradition. Which is funny. One of the things he said was that he only gets money from workers, not the higher-ups. And he thought that was a great defense. Again, he needs to work on his comebacks because I don't know if you've ever made a political donation, but there's no blank to fill in where you list your job title and how much, you know, it's ridiculous. But he wants you to believe he's a man of the working people, as all socialists try to portray themselves. That's a fascinating tidbit you learn when traveling the world. So as you know, my favorite city in the world is Prague, which is in Czech Republic. Well, under Soviet communism, if you had a storefront, you were required to put a sign in the window that said, "Workers of the World Unite," which of course is the lie that keeps society under control, that you're united as workers, all being equal, and then some are more equal than others, and they're the ones that control you. But what you're demonstrating to the others who live under this oppressive regime is that you're bought into the lie. So you're signaling, and because the workers of the world aren't united any more than the L and the G in the LGBTQ coalition. And this is, of course, what makes Elon Musk maybe the most impressive human the world's ever seen. Because in addition to his entrepreneurial successes, he stood up to save free speech in America. And the reason that's so courageous is because when you're living under a repressive communist system where free speech isn't allowed, when you speak up, when you tell the truth, you're usually imprisoned or killed. Because if enough people realize what's happening, that the regime implodes. It's the lies that keep them afloat. That's why Chernobyl led to the fall of the Soviet Union, because people realized that there were a lot of people who agreed with them, that this was all BS, and we need to do something about all the incompetence. And this is something that Vaclav Havel talks about in his book. Vaclav Havel was the president of Czechoslovakia at the end of the Soviet Empire, 1989, fall of the Berlin Wall and all that. So he led Czechoslovakia from 89 to 92, and he wrote a book called The Power of the Powerless. Actually, the train station in Prague is named for him. Super impressive dude. He said if you speak out against the regime, you're basically risking it all, because you can't know how many people agree with you. If there are only two or three of you, you'll be unalived real quick, or at least sent to Gulag. Because even if 10% of the population agree with you, you're all likely to be persecuted. That's how the political opponents of the revolution get thrown in jail, which of course we witnessed for the first time in America's 250-year history, all the lawfare, and we had political prisoners for the first time. Show me the man and I'll show you the crime. It was one of many firsts in America under the Biden administration. Yeah, put Joe Biden on Mount Rushmore. Under Soviet communism, people would get grabbed off the street to be sent away to the work camps in the frozen tundra that is Siberia. And the first thing out of most of their mouths when they would be arrested, they would say, "What for?" And oftentimes it was their neighbor who ratted them out for having the wrong political views, or a family member. Hell, sometimes it was the wives who ratted out their husbands, or vice versa. Communism is not something to mess around with, but we flirted with it in recent years. By the way, it's also been a truism under communist regimes that a lot of the population don't know what's happening. It's not just the useful idiots, it's your average citizen. It's not their fault. You don't want to have to pay attention to politics if you don't have to. And then things happen what seems like rather suddenly. There's a story of one writer who went to Russia during the revolution, and he was visiting a movie theater about 100 miles or 100 kilometers south of Moscow, and he couldn't believe how many people were oblivious to what was happening in their country. They were just going about their merry lives. An election could be stolen in front of your eyes, and they'd be none the wiser. So maybe we should feel fortunate that in 2020 we had the most free and fair election in the history of elections, right? If you disagree, try sharing that on social media in 2021, following that election. You would have been set straight pretty quick. You'd have had a disinformation label slapped on you or silenced completely by kicking you off the social media platform. So what Elon Musk did in buying Twitter and returning free speech to the people was one of the most courageous things a man of his stature, with all the world to lose, it's one of the bravest things you could possibly do. And so lucky for him, and lucky for us, what he found was that way more than 10% of Americans agreed with him. And if Trump hadn't won, there's a good chance he'd be in court, and then if they had success, they'd have him behind bars, I'm afraid. But we're free at last, thank God Almighty. You know what they say? Well, let me not go there. But the truth will eventually come out. Solzhenitsyn was the biggest truth teller. He spent a lot of time in Gulag and then wrote the Gulag Archipelago, and that's how a lot of the world finally discovered what was happening in Soviet Russia all that time, Soviet Union. Our politicians, I don't know if they've been covering up the mental health status of school shooters, but it seems like it, right? That trans shooter in Nashville, he had written a manifesto that was kept under wraps because it could harm our politicians in power. I don't know whether that's evil or not, but It'd be good for Americans to know that a school shooter was on SSRIs, for example, so we could do something about it. If Dems are protecting their positions of power at the cost of a more informed society, a healthier society, as in the case of RFK and what he's trying to do, I'd probably call that evil. He's going against the moneyed interests, the corruption. And the Kennedys have a history of going against corruption, and we know what happened there. So that's why I ask for prayers, you know, at the end of my last article, I asked for a prayer. We're living through dangerous times. And I keep talking about how there's evil among us. I'm concerned too many of us don't recognize when evil is in our midst. But it's a story as old as time, just as much a part of human nature as lust or greed or you name it. And for some, it'll only be in hindsight that what we were witnessing was in fact evil. You know, when you're in the fog of war, when you're going through COVID, I've always said it's going to take 50 years. People will look back and say, which it might have been accelerated with this administration. But I always thought that people were going to look back 50 years from now and say, wait a minute, this guy that they labeled as Hitler, who they tried to impeach twice, and they had a worldwide virus that came from China at the same time he was running for re-election when the economy was rolling and everything seemed to be fine. It seemed to me like he was going to be reelected, because usually incumbents are judged based on the economy. So the economy had to be wrecked. Convenient, right? Pocahontas took money from the Sackler family. You believe that? She got campaign contributions from Purdue Pharma, Purdue to Poca, and not in-kind contributions. I'm talking about cold, hard cash. An in-kind contribution is when you give goods or services in lieu of cash. No, she got greenbacks, straight bennies. I don't know if trying to impeach your political opponent on ridiculous pretenses is evil, but that whole story is amazing too, because it dealt with Ukraine. He was asking to, hey, you guys look into this corruption, because Biden was on video saying he was doing the quid pro quo thing, where he said, you're not getting the $1 billion unless you fire this prosecutor who's going after the prince's company, energy company. And then, of course, I don't think these evil people are smart enough to come up with ideas, so they just used what they were doing. I mean, everything was projection. So they accused Trump of quid pro quo, of course. So, yeah, I don't know if that's evil, but something that had never been done, trying to put the political opponent in a cage for the rest of his life, that is not something that had been done in America's history. And that is a hell of a precedent to set. A hellish precedent to set is more like it. Trying to kill him is definitely evil. And what else? Mutilating children? Cutting off their D&Bs before they're old enough to give consent? COVID? I don't plan to opine further on COVID until the facts come out, because I think that'll be soon. But you remember I used to ask the question in the fun questions part of the podcast. I'd say, do you think COVID was deliberate? And there's a reason I asked that question. But yeah, I'll save it. With regard to child mutilation, think of it this way. These evil people believe a kid is old enough to grant consent to somebody to give them pain down there by way of reassignment surgery or whatever they call it, but not old enough to give consent to experience pleasure down there. Isn't that something? The age of consent is 16 in most states, 31 out of 50. It's 17 where I live in Texas. But the age of consent varies around the world. I learned a lot about Hungary last year because we spent a month in Budapest, and I'd see girls walking down the sidewalk that were maybe 14, that were dressed like they were 22. But the age of consent there, I looked it up, it was 14. And by law, sexual activity is permitted with 12-year-olds, as long as the other party to the sex party is 17 or younger. Seems gross to me, but even in Thailand, the age of consent is 15. What's another example of evil? Under the Trump administration, AOC went to the border and had somebody take a picture of her holding onto a fence, crying her eyes out. I must admit, though, the Dems found in her a star in the making, if she's not a star already. Because, remember, Dems determine who their next rising star is based on their acting ability. Washington, D.C. is Hollywood for ugly people. But in AOC, I mean, I'm sure they could have found somebody smarter, but they managed to find somebody who is not only not ugly, but whose ability to perform in front of a camera is nearly unparalleled in Washington. Like, she's got the Instagram game down. She can do a selfie. And this is kind of something I talked about with a client recently. He had an upcoming negotiation, and I was telling him not to feel obligated to answer every question. You know, sometimes you want to do like a politician and filibuster, or maybe this is an example. If you're asked what your salary expectations are, don't give them a number. Don't do that. And the reason you don't want to do that is because you can't know if you're leaving money on the table. By the way, if you ever find yourself in that situation, and most of you will at some point, if you haven't already, here's some unsolicited advice. Call it a negotiating tip. Let's say you're interviewing and you have a figure in mind that you'd be content with. Maybe it's $110,000 a year salary. Then you're in the interview and they tell you the position you're applying for has a salary range of 100 to 120. And you might be happy with 110, but what you want to do is hone in on the 120. Because what they've done by giving you a range is they're trying to anchor you, meaning those are the numbers they want you negotiating from. You'd probably be best to ignore it entirely, but the best thing you could do for yourself is repeat the number at the top of the range and go radio silent, which is very hard to do, I realize. I told one of the guys I coached to do his best to act surprised with a disappointed look on his face and not talk for 30 seconds, and he told me he made it 5 or 6 seconds. So I know it's hard to do. I get it. Dealing with that awkward silence it's not easy. It's uncomfortable, but all the rewards, all the rewards you truly want in life are on the other side of discomfort. Doesn't matter if it's a negotiation or asking that hot piece out to dinner or busting your ass in the gym consistently, trying to get fit. You know, unlike the gym, these intense negotiations aren't something you get to do regularly. You don't get a lot of practice, which puts you at a disadvantage because in all likelihood, your employer does this pretty regularly. You can practice some if you have a personal coach like me, but most people negotiate, what, 3 or 4 times by the time they're my age, in their 40s? But take it from me, I've made a living negotiating and have helped many people successfully navigate the interview process and get paid. And, you know, I've done a lot of deals, both real estate and, well, doing probably 100-something real estate deals negotiating on behalf of someone else, which is what you want to do if you can to detach yourself emotionally. You want to act as though you're negotiating on your behalf if you can, which is kind of viewing player one, you know, viewing your life objectively. And of course, I've done software deals. I say all that to say I know it's not easy. I've been there. And if you're not disagreeable, you won't be any good at it, which I happen to be disagreeable. So if you're not, you'll require more coaching than those who are. So, yeah, whether you're negotiating a raise or a real estate deal or, hell, in your personal life, like negotiating with a 4-year-old who says, it's not time to go to bed yet, Daddy, because I'm not tired. None of that's easy. You just got to try to remember you're not negotiating against someone. You're negotiating with someone. If it's adversarial, you're in a bad negotiation. And the thing to know there is you can't do a good deal with a bad guy. I have a story about an adversarial negotiation I had one time. The fellow I was negotiating with had an ego the size of the crib, and he was a former friend of mine. I'll tell you why I say former in a minute here, but he wanted me to come and work on the team that he managed. And he tells me that, he told me what my quota would be if I came to work on his team. And so I asked him if the salary corresponded to the quota, because the way it often works in tech sales is using round numbers. If you have a salary of 100 and you hit your quota, you make double your salary. They call it OTE or on-target earnings. So in this example, you have a salary of 100, your OTE might be 200. Well, when I asked him if the salary corresponded to the quota that way, he got pissed, like genuinely upset. And I said, man, are you okay? And he says, no, dude, you just pissed me off. And I said, why? He said, because you're coming at me like you made $400K last year, bro. Something to note there. The best predictor of what your next salary will be is your current salary. And so he was right. I didn't make $400 the prior year, and he knew that. So I said to him, it's interesting, you're pissed. Remember, this is my friend. I believe he's maybe a year older than me. And I always thought he was a stud guy, like strong business acumen. I thought I knew his skill set. If I didn't, I probably wouldn't have taken the meeting. But I was totally taken aback when he started to get emotional. And I said, it's interesting, you're pissed. I thought we were just having a business discussion. And if the roles were reversed, I'd try to get you as much money as I could. And that didn't cheer him up. He said, you know what he said to me? He said, okay, dude, let's talk on Monday. I'll call you at 5 p.m. I said, okay, thanks, man. That was many years ago. He still hasn't called. Pretty sad, right? That money discussion we had, that was the last time I ever spoke with him. So that's why I say former friend. There are a few takeaways there. So in a successful negotiation, everybody wins. That's how you know whether you've done a good deal, when both sides feel like they've won. If you'll allow me to toot my own horn a minute, which I guess you're forced to, right? You don't have a choice. But yeah, if you don't toot your own horn, you've got to rely on others to do it. And you want to be independent, not having to rely on other people. Stay tuned for more philosophical wisdom. But seriously, my assessment of that interaction, the discussion I just mentioned, is, and I think this is a lesson for all of us, which is his inability to detach himself emotionally, what that cost him, and what did it cost him? And this is where I get to tootin', but I try to be objective and view myself as player one in the world. It cost him a potential member of his team who could really help to drive revenue. Because I've been known to be a little conscientious and, you know, some might say obsessively so, but I had a solid track record of getting deals done. I strive for excellence in everything I do. I don't care if it's being a good father or friend or investor, salesperson, blogger, what I'm doing now, you know, everything. And if I'm successful, which I'm going to be, or I'm going to die trying, my success is going to enrich him. He might even, and this is a stretch, I realize, but regularly interacting with me, one of these Wednesdays, he might learn something from me. Like this one guy did one time. I'm kidding. The sort of person I referenced isn't the type who can learn something from someone that they perceive to be beneath them, so far beneath them, which is another downside to having an outsized ego, of course. And you see this all the time in the corporate world, those who don't think they can learn anything from someone without the title that they've so coveted. It's sad, but true, which is something I can't say without thinking about the weight room in high school. I don't know. Do you remember having Metallica playing at all times in the weight room when you were in high school? That was always on our speakers. Another takeaway is you want to make sure you're developing relationships outside of the workplace. Because one of the biggest surprises for me when I exited the corporate world is that a lot of the people you think are your friends, they are not your friends. And unfortunately, most people never get to experience what I'm talking about, unless you're willing to switch professions or retire early. Those guys who call you buddy all the time, the guy who calls you buddy too much, yeah, that's bullshit. You'll probably hang on to a few friends, and I certainly do, but for the most part, as soon as you can't aid their career, can't help them in any way to advance, you're forgotten. You're a gone pecan. Actually, I'm just thinking of this now, but the fellow I'm talking about, he once asked me to write a letter of recommendation on his behalf and send it to his boss when he was lobbying for the promotion that put him in a position to recruit me. And I did. And that's what friends are for, right? But you may remember me saying this. I believe, I want to say I got it from Nassim Taleb. He said, true generosity is when you help the ingrate, which is ingrate is derived from ingratitude. So don't be that guy, because I imagine he thinks he won by not calling. Like, I'll show this dude who bruised my fragile ego who's boss, but you know, knowing what I know about human nature, he probably would have been a tyrant of a person to work for. Not to mention showing himself to be someone who is not a man of his word, right? So then you have to question his integrity, and then somebody, he obviously wouldn't go to bat for you internally, which is, you need a boss who would do that. Somebody who ask you what to do rather than tell you what to do. But I probably contradicted myself there in that we both walked away feeling like a winner, probably, which by definition is what makes it a good negotiation, except in a different world where you had two guys whose values were more closely aligned, it would have been more fruitful for both of us had we agreed to figure, and I would have gone to work on his team. There's another lesson there about the importance of leverage and being able to walk away, but we'll save that for another time. Having kids helps with the ingratitude thing because it'll be years before you get a thank you. A few days ago, I was doing something on my laptop, and my daughter walked up to me and said, "What are you doing, Daddy?" And I said, "I'm just working on something." And she said, "Why do you have to work?" And I said, "Because Daddy has to pay for stuff." I said, "This house we live in, your gymnastics, daycare." And she stopped me right there. She put her hand up and said, "School?" Because she calls daycare school. And she said, "You don't have to pay for school. I can just go." That was the cutest thing. Because when we go somewhere, like Walgreens or something, she'll bring her little coin purse and try to pay for stuff. Or when we, let's say I get the check at dinner at a restaurant, I'll say, "Are you going to get this one?" And she likes that. She grabs her coin purse and she gets ready. So she understands that you have to exchange money for things that you want to buy, but she never, at daycare, she never sees money changing hands. So as she says, "You can just go." But yeah, I will say, sometimes when you stop working with a friend, some of them are sincerely too busy to meet up with you, especially during the day, like grab lunch. And I know because I've been there. I had a former coworker that I used to take to lunch. I liked her a lot. In fact, when we'd go to lunch, I liked her so much, I would pay. And just to give you an idea of how fond of this friend I was, I mean, she was probably 20 years older than me, but she had retired and I inherited some of her accounts. She was my former coworker, and it turned out to be pretty lucrative for me. So since she played a part in that, I thought it'd be a nice thing to do to always pick up the check. And so she was the Roy Oswalt to my Billy Wagner, let's say. It would be no different than a running back buying Rolexes for his offensive lineman, except in this case, you know, she had already retired. Well, the last time I ever asked her if she wanted to grab lunch, and you obviously know why I say ever asked her. I wouldn't ask her again. But the last time I asked if she had talked to this other gal that we used to work with. And I said, you know, I've tried. She asked me if I talked to her. And I said that I tried to contact her a few times, but I said, she is so busy. And she was truly busy. Like, she had gotten this promotion where she was traveling to Japan and EMEA all the time. And she'd have to drive to company headquarters, which was a few hours away. So she truly didn't have time to do a non-work-related lunch. And when you're in enterprise sales, you feel guilty even having lunch with a friend because you could be opportunity cost, right? You could be taking a customer or a prospect to lunch, and time is money. And you not only have a quota, but you're judged on how many meetings you have, that kind of thing. So you are all in on your J-O-B. Anyway, since I used to work with this girl that had this new important job, and I knew her work ethic, so when she said she was too busy, I knew that. I mean, I got it. I understood. Well, this other girl, who I'd hit up to see if she wanted to grab lunch, you know what she said to me? Because I had told her that this other girl was busy, but she says, "Oh, I'm so busy." And I'm like, what? Okay. Well, remember my advice from long ago, one of the first solo podcasts I did? I said, if a friend ever tells you they're busy, it means you're not a priority. And if they don't suggest another day and time, that means you're really not a priority. But that's a good thing because it enables you to reprioritize your own time. I don't remember what I did for lunch that day, but I probably had lunch with my best man, the guy I mentioned earlier, who, when we're both in Houston, you know, we have lunch all the time. But he's not a guy I met at work. We've been friends for 30 years. And I've long said it's better to have a small tribe of friends, some ride or dies, and spend your time deepening those relationships than to have a whole bevy of surface level friendships. You want to keep your inner circle tight and try to surround yourself with studs who are better than you if you can, which I've always been blessed to do, to be able to do. The other heuristic you can use is the Brad Pitt test. And this works not just in a dating context, but with your friends. If you ask yourself, if I were Brad Pitt, would he or she make time to meet me? And if the answer to that question is yes, you are best to phase that person out of your life because they don't value you. You want people in your life who value you and your time, not some celebrities. And so, yeah, it helps if they like you a lot, of course. But it amazes me how much people will put up with to be able to call somebody a friend. Like, let them down time after time after time, and they'll say, "Oh, well, I've known them for 20 years." Well, that's not a reason to keep letting them abuse your time. Remember, people will value their own time 1,000x to one your time, if not 1,000x to zero. So just something to be mindful of. Life is brief, even at its longest. Live to 93, and it's still going to seem like life flew by. Time flies. So you want to grab it by the short and curlies if you can, and live with a little sense of urgency. Spend time with those you love, and most importantly, those who love you back. Don't cry because you lost a friend. People are going to come and go. And sometimes you've got to let them go, because not everybody was meant to be in your life. But those who are meant to be in your life, they're not going anywhere. Those are your ride or dies. They'll be there for you. So don't frown because they're gone. Smile because you had them for that brief but beautiful moment in time. And tell people you love them, because I've talked to men who've lost loved ones and told me how much they regretted not telling that person how much they meant to them. And in that regard, you want to express yourself like it's your last day on earth. We never know when we're going to go. People often talk about their deathbed, but you know, when you're on your deathbed, you'll look back at your life, and all that's going to matter to you on your dying day is that you're whatever. But we're not guaranteed a deathbed experience. Think about the folks who were about to land in D.C. last week. You know, they were probably texting whoever they were going to meet somebody, or somebody was going to pick them up from the airport, and they didn't make it, of course. The next moment, they were in the river, still wearing their seatbelt. It's awful to think about. So yeah, you're not guaranteed a deathbed experience. A lot of times when you die, it's like a fish being scooped up in a net. One moment you're checking your phone at 3:15 a.m. on a wild night on Bourbon Street, and then something happens and you don't live to see 3:16 a.m. That's what I'm talking about. We don't know how or when or where we'll go. Remember the late, great Charlie Munger said that all I want to know is where I'll die, so I never go there. He lived to 99. So you can either allow that realization to freak you out, or you can take solace in knowing that this is something we all, every human, must face. So meditate on your own mortality. Memento mori is the Stoic wisdom there. And embrace uncertainty. Penetrate the world with your God-given gifts and make the most of the one life you get. Remember what Confucius said. We all have two lives, and the second one starts when you realize that you only have one. So start that one. How terrible is it that some people are never told how much they mean to people? You go to a funeral and you hear all these wonderful things said about someone, and I sit there and think, man, this is awesome. I sure hope he got to hear how much he meant to people when he was alive. But sadly, a lot of times that's not the case. So as it pertains to the people you love, knowing you're not guaranteed a deathbed experience, tell them how much they mean to you now. Do it now. Not so much now, but now. Tell people you love them. Here's a thought for those who struggle with confidence. I would argue telling another man you love him would help you to build confidence. Why is that? Because it's one of the things people are afraid to do. It's discomforting. It's something men are scared of. But it'll help you to build that muscle having done it, growing stronger and more confident in the process, knowing that you have expressed yourself authentically. And in all likelihood, they'll say it back, but if they don't, it doesn't matter. And you know what? I could make the case that not hearing it back would build even more confidence because, well, it can be awkward. But just like uncomfortable conversations, you want to put yourself out there. I know you've heard this before, but your success can be directly attributed to the amount of uncomfortable conversations you're willing to have. So to me, that's an easy one. Should I do some Gerwinder? I think he has a good one that I haven't done. Yeah, reminiscence bump. Americans of all ages tend to believe America peaked morally, politically, economically, artistically, whenever they were a kid. Perhaps people who yearn for the time when their country was great are mostly just yearning for their childhood. I have this weird connection to my childhood. It's weird in that I haven't come across a lot of people who remember their childhood as well as I do. Except maybe one dude who I had on the podcast, Dr. Brian Roundtree. He's a very successful dentist in Thibodaux, Louisiana. Or yeah, B, I'm impressed by your memory, my man. So in my case, I can't say why I remember so much of my early days, but it is a blessing, especially if you're able to learn a lot from the negative aspects of your upbringing, which I think I have, it can benefit you in so many ways. So then there's no issue reflecting on the past. A lot of people have trouble with that. And it always helps to remember people. What's more important than people? Just about nothing. Remembering things bonds you to people in a special way, because you may be calling attention to something they've forgotten, but something that meant something to you, and they appreciate that you've remembered it, remembered them. I went to see a buddy last year whose wife was my girlfriend when I was like 12 and 13. And one of the things I remember about being this super smitten seventh grader with this girl was how we used to smile at each other from across the hall. We had this certain class, this one period where for that hour of the day, we had a class across from each other, and the teachers would leave the door open a lot of days. And it was a little special something that meant something to me at the time. So I remember it because it lit me up at the time. And there's some emotion involved. And remember, when a memory is tied to an emotion, it's much more likely to stick. So back then, I was disappointed that we were never put in the same class. But I thought it was a mixed blessing, because if she were in my class, she would see that, you know, I wasn't the brightest student. But the downside was I thought if she were in my class, I'd probably be inspired to do better in school. Anyway, I mentioned that to her, and I asked if she remembered it, and she didn't. But how cool is this? When I moved away to another state at that age, when I was 13, she started dating my best friend. And they started dating when they were 13 or they were 14, I guess. And then 10 years later, he asked me to be in their wedding. So they've been together for 30 years. How cool is that? They have two kids. He's got a beautiful family, as so many of my friends do. You know what that experience did for me? I wasn't happy when I had to move away. It felt kind of like a rug pull, because I had my life all mapped out at the time. But if there was anyone that I would have wanted her to date, and anyone I'd want him to date, which is what I said at their reception, I would have wanted them to have each other, because I thought they were both just awesome people. And it's worked out wonderfully. When I talk to their friends, they're like, oh, they are the ideal couple. But in a weird way, I feel like that experience prepared me for what I would go through later in life, because I dated a girl for like 6.5 years, from maybe 17 to 23. And when we broke up, she started dating one of the guys I played baseball with, and she married him. So I'm happy for them too, but it was easier to take once I had been through that already in my life. So I'm happy for people. Let's do kids say the darndest things. A few nights ago, I was putting my daughter to bed, and who is 4 now. She just had a birthday in January, and she had a unicorn theme for her party. So I'm putting her to bed, and I tell her, be sure to say your prayers. And she says to me, how come we always have to pray to God? And I answered her question as best I could. And I'll keep most of the conversation between us, because it was pretty special. But then she asked me, where does God live? And I said, heaven. And she says, what is heaven? And I said, oh, it's a magical place. It has everything you could ever dream of. And she got excited and said, like castles and unicorns? And I said, yes. And she thinks about it and she says, Jesus probably lives there too. And I said, yes, Jesus is the Son of God, just like you're the daughter of me. And she says, no, I'm the daughter of Mommy. She grabs her stuffy and she gets what she calls warm and cozy. And she looks at me and she says, can you tell me a story? Okay, folks, I talked about some heavy stuff today. Please pray for our country. Not only have we experienced a lot of inflation, which is another form of taxation, but as Naval Ravikant has said, the real tax is society forcing otherwise productive people to pay attention to politics. And especially pray for those that we've elected to lead our great nation. The movie we're watching is amazing, but I would rather it not be R-rated, if you know what I mean. We have a lot of people in our country right now who are probably feeling an overwhelming sense of anxiety and maybe desperate to avoid accountability for whatever they've done. What we don't want is violence. Thank you for tuning in. I never take it lightly that you're here. Feel free to contact me if you need anything. And so there are a couple of things that I didn't get right. You know how I was saying last episode that sometimes you catch things after the fact that you got wrong or wish you hadn't said. Well, I know I caught myself in discussion here where Valdosta State is not the team Nicholls State played. They played Valparaiso. That is Bryce Drew's alma mater. And I also said something about 20% when I said quartile. I meant 25%. That's it. Thank you, folks.